Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm Ira Melman. Washingtonians welcome back one of the iconic components of their city's skyline.
Most of the earthquake damage that this building sustained back in 2011 was at the upper levels of the monument. So that required a very elaborate scaffolding system and very expert stonemasons who could come and do the repairs here.
Victor Beatty has the story of the reopened Washington Monument. Controversy continues over even revamped plans to open a mosque near the site where the World Trade Center stood before the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks.
Honestly, what we need is more candor about jihad and the jihadic doctrine.
Bernard Chessman visits the cafe with that story. And Deborah Block is here with a look at a different kind of race in the city of Baltimore.
It is a celebration of ingenuity, engineering, creativity, and just surprising the public of Baltimore with something weird and wacky.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. The Washington Monument reopened to the public last week after being closed for almost 3 years to repair damage from a rare earthquake that hit the nation's capital. VOA's Victor Beatty has the story on the monumental reopening.
The monument, located in the heart of the city's National Mall, was shaken by the August 23rd earthquake, whose epicenter was about 145 kilometers southwest of Washington. Falling mortar and pieces of stone struck visitors inside, causing minor injuries. Everyone was safely evacuated. A post-quake assessment revealed cracks, spalls, and displacement of stones and joints, forcing its closure to the public. The structure was covered by scaffolding as it underwent repairs at a cost of $15 million, half of it paid by businessman and philanthropist David Rubenstein. James Perry is with the National Mall and Memorial Parks, an administrative unit of the National Park Service, which oversees the capital city's national memorials.
Most of the earthquake damage that this building sustained back in 2011 was at the upper levels of the monument. So that required a very elaborate scaffolding system and very expert stonemasons who could come and do the repairs here. And here at the ground level, you can actually see a variety of the types of techniques that are used to restore a building like the Washington Monument. So right behind me is what's known as a Dutchman. This is simply a piece of the same type of stone. In this case, it's marble from Maryland, just like much of the rest of the Washington Monument. And where there's a damaged piece of stone, a piece of new stone is cut and shaped and fit in that area.
New exhibits have been installed at the Washington Monument, and visitors can once again ride an elevator to the top, the highest point in the federal city. Construction of the monument, a tribute to the nation's first president, George Washington, began as a private venture in 1848. First, funds ran out, and then the Civil War interrupted building efforts until Congress authorized resumption of construction in 1876. The monument was finally completed in 1884 and dedicated the following year. It was the world's tallest structure until completion of the Eiffel Tower in Paris in 1889 and attracts about 800,000 visitors a year. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
For many Americans, memories of the September 11th terror attacks in New York City are still vivid. A new World Trade Center is soon to open at the site where the original one was destroyed. There's also a plan to build a Muslim community center and mosque nearby, though it is a more modest version of a previous one steeped in controversy. VOA's Bernard Chessman has an update from New York City.
The new World Trade Center is nearing completion 13 years after the September 11th attacks. There's also a plan to build a Muslim center with a museum and mosque three blocks from Ground Zero. Even though it's a scaled-back version of a previous one, it too is controversial. The proposal includes a three-story building with a small mosque, a community center, and a museum devoted to Islam. Imam Talib Abdul Rashid, president of the Islamic Leadership Council, says the project should reflect the full story of Islam.
Islam itself, as one of the three global Abrahamic traditions, and then two, and I tend to kind of lean more towards the second, is a discussion and an accurate depiction of Muslims in America generally, and in New York City in particular.
In 2010, there were loud protests at the site against the previous plan. It called for a 15-story Muslim mosque and community center. The demonstrators, including relatives of those killed in the September 11 attacks, argued it was insensitive to build an Islamic complex so close to Ground Zero.
We're wide open to religious freedom, but not in this spot.
The original plan called Park 51 was dropped, but the new one is drawing opposition too, although its details have yet to be released. Pamela Geller is president of the American Freedom Defense Initiative.
Honestly, what we need is more candor about jihad and the jihadic doctrine. Is his museum going to explore at all the 1,400 years of jihadi wars, land appropriations, cultural annihilations, and enslavements? I think not. I think it's going to whitewash, and I think it's inappropriate at Ground Zero. We have to see the plans.
This visiting group of college students and professors from Canada had an exclusive briefing by one of the developers at the site. Alexandra Bain, a professor of religious studies, believes a living history of Islam is important to the community and the world.
Muslims have been in America since the slaves came over. Muslims are some of the first Americans, and they continue to be an important and vibrant part of American culture.
The developers have not fully disclosed the plans, nor where all the funding is coming from. But they insist these buildings will soon come down and be replaced with an exciting structure dedicated to exploring the faith of Islam and its arts and culture. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
There's an age-old tension between honoring tradition and embracing innovation. A family-owned sporting goods company in suburban Seattle, Washington, is confronting that tension in the sport of baseball. This company is going to market what it calls a better baseball bat. Correspondent Tom Bonsi eyes the pitch.
The traditional round-handled baseball bat has been a fixture on sandlots and in stadiums around much of the world for more than a century. Back when bats were turned out on a lathe, there was good reason for the symmetrical design. But now, computer-guided machine tools can churn out any shape you want. So if you could choose, why not go for a more ergonomic handle? It makes sense to former baseball coach Rusty Trudeau.
The concept from the standpoint is the ergonomics of an axe. It's been around forever, and there's a reason why.
Trudeau is now a national account manager for Baden Sports of Renton in the northwest U.S. state of Washington. He shows off his company's patented axe bat. The barrel looks the same as always, but while a traditional bat has a circular knob at the base of a round handle, this new bat has an oval grip and an angled knob. Trudeau ticks off attributes he claims result from the redesign: better back control, more power, and lower risk of hand injuries compared to the traditional style.
That round knob protruding into the palm or the hammock bone area of your hand creates a lot of injuries. In fact, when we presented to Major League Baseball, that was a key factor in our presentation, is keeping the money in the game, preventing injury, hand fatigue.
Trudeau and Baden Sports have embarked on what will probably be a lengthy campaign to convince players of America's so-called pastime to try something new. There were several of the new bats in the dugout for a showdown of high school baseball division leaders in Lacey, Washington recently. The Timberline High School team used one in warm-ups, but during the actual game, all the players wielded regular bats. They reverted to what they knew best, says Tyler Gartner. He's an infielder and pitcher who's tried the new style bat.
I like the pop from it. The downfall is kind of the handle a little bit, because you can't move your hand around as much.
Gardner says he prefers to rotate his grip, but he gives the new geometry a chance to catch on with players who have different preferences.
I won!
Timberline High School head coach Matt Acker also figures the axe-handled bat will eventually capture some market share. He says the youngest players are among the most open to equipment change.
It automatically feels better to a younger kid. If you give it to, I've handed them to younger kids before that are, 7 years old, and you just let them pick one, they'll pick that one because it feels the best. It feels natural to you.
Acker says change in baseball takes time. There's superstition, too. Rusty Trudeau of batmaker Baden Sports says he appreciates what he's up against.
Baseball's a very tradition-driven sport, so that is a challenge at times.
Trudeau invites lots of players to test the unusual bat. He's also signed a number of college teams to swing the axe-handled bat exclusively. Baden, though, has a smaller marketing budget than its bigger competitors. Trudeau hopes to get more high-profile endorsers as college players turn pro.
We really think that we're going to overcome. We know we're going to overcome this. This is going to be the handle of the future.
Wooden and metal axe bats have been approved for use at all levels of baseball and softball, from kids' little league teams to the major leagues. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Lacey, Washington.
In most races, the person who crosses the finish line first wins. Not so at the Kinetic Sculpture Race, where awards are given in categories such as Best Artistic Design, Most Memorable Breakdown, and the coveted Next to Last Award. VOA's Deborah Block tells us more about this fun and crazy race of human-powered floats in Baltimore, Maryland.
Here they come down the first stretch of the 24-kilometer race. Floats powered by people and bicycles. It didn't take long for this one, designed by school children, to break down as the tires constantly blew out. Dustin Kimmett learned a lesson.
Let's wait on one tire.
David Wuffel hopped off his float to help another competitor.
We're here to help each other and have a good time.
It's the 16th year of the Kinetic Sculpture Race, sponsored by the American Visionary Art Museum. Communications Director Nick Privas is also a competitor.
It is a celebration of ingenuity, engineering, creativity, and just surprising the public of Baltimore with something weird and wacky.
Les Lorenz says he enjoys creating the floats.
Solving all the problems and making the parts and putting it together.
The floats also have to float because the race takes them into Baltimore's harbor. Adam Davis didn't give up after having mechanical problems.
The crowd just gave me the motivation just to push through, and I just gave all.
Sand and mud pose another challenge along the route. These two friends were on a float that never made it this far and decided to run into the mud themselves.
The spirit of the race. You just do it because it's fun.
Spectator Chailey Hoover got into the spirit, too.
I love things that are just over the top, and this seemed just utterly perfect.
Kinetic cops along the race route issue tickets. But Maura Roth Gormley says they are not above being bribed.
I got lots of delicious baked goods, some homemade candy, lots of little toy, action hero type of guys.
It's not clear how winners are chosen in categories like best costume or conquering course obstacles, as this judge explains it.
It's completely arbitrary, and if we're in a good mood, we might give you a good score.
But Nick Privas points out it isn't important who wins or loses.
The winner of this race is actually not who comes in first. Our race is actually more about mediocrity. And so it is whoever comes in right in the middle of the race, that's the winner.
This couple feels like winners already. They met at the event 3 years ago.
So I thought this sounded pretty cool and like a great way to meet people. Little did I know that I was going to meet my husband.
And so we've done the race every year as a celebration of meeting here.
And the craziness continues next year. Deborah Block, VOA News, Baltimore.
Scientists have long feared that once people start traveling to other planets, it would be impossible to prevent certain types of microorganisms traveling with them. Given favorable conditions, they suggest these stowaways could colonize and contaminate pristine environments. VOA's George Pudich talked with a scientist who is researching the problem.
Earlier this month, scientists from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory released a paper saying microorganisms could hitch a ride on spacecraft launched from Earth and easily colonize Mars or other planets. But questions abound. How could bacteria survive in extreme conditions, and how could they colonize a planet if it has no water or nutrients to sustain life? The lead scientist in the NASA study, microbiologist and environmental community analyst, Dr. Kasturi Venkat, says there is a difference between survival and colonization.
Survive is not to die, colonize is to proliferate. I want to make that distinction clear here.
Strong radiation kills most bacteria, but if somehow shielded from radiation, Venkat says, they may survive other harsh conditions. Some microorganisms form resistant structures called spores that are metabolically inactive and can survive in that state for a long time.
Maybe a year or a million years to find that favorable conditions to get out of the seed into a sprouting thing.
NASA is taking extreme care to clean and sterilize hardware that lands or may land on other planets, and scientists are constantly working with various microbes to develop measures for preventing hitchhikers from compromising NASA's goals. But Venkat says in the distant future, it is inevitable that some bacteria will find a way to reach other planets.
Once it finds the subsurface where the radiation get shielded, that might be a different scenario. Because subsurface, you might find some nutrients which we do not know yet.
In an effort to prevent that, scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory are researching how bacteria survive in extreme harsh environments here on Earth, like acidic and alkaline hot springs. George Puttich, VOA News, Washington.
Before he turned 25, Adam Braun had a vision of what he wanted to do in life and the legacy he wanted to leave behind. In 2008, Braun founded Pencils of Promise, a nonprofit, or what he prefers to call a for-purpose organization, to ensure all children have access to education. 6 years later, Braun's organization is breaking ground on a new school every 90 hours and has reached more than 22,000 children in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Faiza Al-Masri has the story of what's been identified as one of the world's most impactful new nonprofits. Faith Lapidus narrates.
It all started when Adam Braun visited India as a college student. A boy begging on the street approached him asking for money. Braun asked the boy what he'd want if he could have anything in the world.
And I thought their answer was going to be a house or a car or a boat, and his answer was a pencil. And so I gave him my pencil, and he just lit up with joy, and I realized that he had never been to school before, and that that was the reality for 57 million children around the world.
After graduation, Braun started working in finance and was on the path to a successful Wall Street career. But he never forgot that boy and the problem he represented.
We live in a world in which every single child can have access to quality education because we have everything necessary already. We have the capability of educating every child. And so I just became immensely committed to helping create that world.
Using social media, Braun spread the word about his mission and raised money. He funded construction of the first Pencils of Promise school in Laos 5 years ago. Since then, his organization has helped finance more than 200 schools in remote rural areas of Laos, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Ghana. In each country, he says, his organization works closely with the ministries of education.
Those are the ones who craft the original curriculum, but we provide additional sanitation, health, and water curriculum, essentially teaching kids to live healthy, holistic lives.
Pencils of Promise, he says, also works closely with the local communities.
Every project is uniquely catered to that community, but 20% of the funding, on average, comes from the community itself. We want locals supporting other locals.
Rallying people around a common goal of education is something that generally brings communities very close together.
Leslie Engel-Young is Director of Impact for Pencils of Promise.
We started saying, okay, how can we get your 20%? What components of labor can you do? You know, what materials do you have you can contribute to the project? And through this really organic conversation, we start building a true partnership with these people.
Young says she's amazed at the feedback they receive from parents and grandparents every time a new school is built. People are willing to pool efforts and resources. They're thrilled to see their kids have an opportunity to learn.
I was just in Ghana at the opening ceremony of a new kindergarten in the community of Likpi, which is in the northern part of the Volta region where we operate in Ghana. And there's probably 300 people sitting around this new school site. One parent got up and said, give the students a charge, basically saying to them, like, this is your school. You need to make the best of it. It is your right to have an education, and now it is your job to take advantage of that right and see where you can go in the future. This school is not going to be enough. We are going to make sure that this is more than a building. Teachers, you are going to show up regularly. You are going to do good work. We are going to help you do that good work. And really just demanding a lot out of people, which is great.
Enthusiasm like that inspired Adam Braun to broaden his organization's reach beyond the elementary school level.
So we developed scholarships, which enable them to continue through secondary school, as well as teacher training. And we are really rigorous about making sure that the programs aren't just beautiful photos and videos of kids, but that we're actually seeing incredible results in the classroom. And if we're not seeing results, then we need to change our programs. So thus far, kids in Pencils of Promise schools progress from one grade to the next at 2 times the national average.
In his new book, The Promise of a Pencil, Ron shares his story, building up his nonprofit, pursuing his dream, and proving that one ordinary person can create extraordinary change. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Growing numbers of undocumented children are facing deportation proceedings in U.S. immigration courts. Some from Central America were apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. Others from Europe or Africa came to the United States as tourists but have overstayed their visas. A New York law project works to provide attorneys to these youths in immigration court where minors facing deportation usually have no advocate. Carolyn Weaver has more.
These young people are being celebrated at a fundraiser for Safe Passage, a project to provide children in immigration court with volunteer attorneys. Lenny Benson is the project's founder.
Last month, there was a 3-year-old sitting in the deportation chair. You have a government prosecutor, you have a judge on the bench, and you have a child sitting with a translator, and in this case, a grandmother. And if the Safe Passage Project were not there, there would be no one standing up for that 3-year-old or helping that grandmother navigate the court system.
Benson, a professor at New York Law School, spends at least 1 day a month in New York immigration court, and often many more, matching volunteer attorneys with child migrants.
Most of the young people we've met, there's a reason they don't want to go home. And that has been not just dire poverty, but real danger in their communities.
She says that while U.S. immigration law grants children special legal protections, it does not provide them lawyers to help secure those rights. Işık Basarır arrived from Turkey at age 15 and found safe passage only after a confusing search.
My sister obtained a green card, I guess a couple of years after I got here, but she didn't have her citizenship back then, so she wasn't able to sponsor me or anything. But we did, go to private lawyers to talk to them. We asked them, if, there's anything we could do. But they always said no, and I said, there's no way.
Life is good over here, and soccer's good, too.
16-year-old Usman Berry came from Guinea at age 8. His parents are dead, and he lives with an uncle. Safe Passage lawyers won him legal residency, too.
And it means a lot because now I could, travel out and inside the country, and I could come back and go. So, I want to visit my country. I could go there and then come back.
Barry is one of a lucky few. Safe Passage and similar projects can help only a handful of all those in need as the numbers of unaccompanied child migrants surge. This year alone, the federal government predicts that more than 60,000 teens and children, most of them from Central America, will be apprehended at the U.S.-Mexican border. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios in Washington, D.C. You can email us at americancafe@voanews.com. You can also give us a telephone call. Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your questions or your comments. For all the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.